G'day expats, welcome to another episode of Expat Chat. We're on episode number 16. Today I am joined by Managing Director Brett Evans of EMEA, or Europe, Middle East and the Africas, and I'm myself, James Ridley, Managing Director for APAC, or Asia Pacific. G'day Brett, how are you going?
Well, thanks James, and yourself?
Yeah, I'm well. Obviously, still working from home, and that's the background. As you can see, the background there with the in the spare room at the moment. But we're very lucky in Australia because there's signs that they are going to be releasing us, and I suppose, and relaxing a lot of the restrictions, especially in Queensland and Western Australia. How is Dubai or the UAE going?
Look, the UAE, we're getting better since we last spoke. I've cut my hair. Not exactly the best job. We released my hair to the public for the webinar last week, so
it looks okay. I haven't had anyone email in and complain yet, so you looking okay.
That's right. Let's just say hairdressers and barbers are safe for their jobs. It wasn't the easiest of tasks.
Oh,
and if you think about it, when you're cutting hair, it's reversed. So yep. you know, and I almost cut my finger off about 3 or 4 times. So I thought, you know, sod this, and I just put 19 mil. Comb on the clippers and just did the whole head, and then I did the sides at a 6. I haven't even looked at the back. It's probably pretty average, but
I don't know. It looks okay actually. I went to a friend who's a hairdresser to get mine. She never cuts males, and I'll be honest, she botched mine. And I've just gone, and you know, when you have something done by a professional, and you sort of look at yourself and like, are you happy? And I'm sort of someone which, when it's those sort of situations, it's like, yeah, it looks okay.
Yeah.
It's too late now, but I think you've done quite well.
Yeah, look, it's necessary evil. We're just coming out of 24-hour lockdown. So as until last weekend, we were in 24-hour lockdown. We're now back to a nighttime curfew. No more than 3 people in the car. You don't need to get police permits to move around, which is good now. Just the biggest thing is going for a walk. You know, you don't realise how much you miss those simple pleasures until you can't do it and you're stuck within the 4 walls of your house.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, like you said, the daily increase is coming down, obviously, locally over there. Australia's done really, really well. And, you know, it's obviously now just a waiting game. I think the US is still in a lot of trouble, as we all know. And, you know, I think even some states over there are actually, relaxing some of their restrictions that are doing quite well. But still wait and see at the moment. We don't want to see a second wave take place. But I suppose more on today's podcast episode, we need to do that disclaimer. But you're pretty good at the disclaimer.
Yep. All information that filters through your ears and eyeballs should be construed as entertainment, and not that we're the best entertainers, but do not take any of this information as personal advice. Please speak to a professional.
That's right, some good faces for radio.
Yeah.
So I suppose today, we'll do a brief little market update and things that have taken place in the last week or two. We're also going to touch base on some further Q&As that came off the back of the webinar last week. Some great content there. I think a lot of questions that a lot of expats probably want answered if we haven't answered them already. So, kicking off with a bit of a brief market update. I mean, I know yesterday we saw NAB release the fact that they're going to be doing quite a large capital raise. I honestly thought the share market would have pulled back, but the ASX 200 and all has actually finished up towards the end of the day. I mean, it's a bit confusing, really, what's happening in the share market compared to a lot of the live data that's coming out.
You can often get a bit of a tug of war between, you know, people with different opinions and different motivations in terms of investing. There's those who want to believe that it's done from a sentiment point of view, and they will sort of, and also, you know, the great term FOMO rally is also another one as well too, where people, they know the market's down. You know, they're not sure when to buy. When they see it rising, they're almost dragged into that because, oh, we don't want to miss out. You know, at the moment, what we've got is divergence of fact and sentiment. You know, obviously, the market's saying that the recovery is happening. It's picking up. However, we're now starting to see data coming out that a lot of countries aren't recovering as quickly. And you're starting to see clusters popping up in places like New Jersey that I saw last night. So to me, the longer this goes on, the bigger the financial impact that it's going to have. And if it was just a wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, in 30 days, we're done and gone, and, you know, sort of borders are open and the world resumes, then yes, this may be the appropriate level for the market. However, in saying that, you know, for every week that goes by, more damage is done. You know, certainly when I look at the markets on the screens, I'm not seeing a market right now with conviction. You know, it's sort of just seesawing as opposed to just all investors that are just running in to buy. You certainly would have a lot of people sitting on the sidelines still, so volumes wouldn't necessarily be that high. And when you see light volumes, the markets can be pushed around quite easily. Coming back to your point about the NAB capital raising, I mean, the reason it probably went up is because the market was probably expecting the banks to want to raise $5 billion, and the fact it was only $3.5 billion is a relief. So a glass half full approach, I guess you could say.
Yeah, well, that's right. I've still got two more, obviously, to come through now that we're getting that earnings guidance season. But, I mean, at the moment, every morning sort of when I log into the Australian Financial Review, it's just every sort of fifth or sixth article, capital raising. So it's obviously a reflection of, you know, the current state that a lot of ASX blue chips are in right now, which is, you know, quite common in these sort of scenarios that play out. I suppose one thing we've also seen is the Australian dollar. I mean, the Australian dollar's come back. I think it's nearly tipped at 65 cents relative to the US dollar, which I honestly thought it was going to stay pretty low for a while. I thought it was going to stay down to 61, 62s, but it's climbing back up there.
And it's look, that's that great risk on, risk off subject that we keep talking about. You know, biggest thing, you can almost, not exactly, but you can almost correlate the Australian market to the dollar, you know, because as overseas investors want to take on more risk, what they'll do is they'll buy Australian dollar and buy into the market as well too. So by doing that, that's why you get that correlation on those two. And if you look at, you know, on the downside, when we saw the biggest falls in the share market was when we saw the biggest falls in the Australian dollar as well too.
Yeah, so that's right.
If we do see a risk-off approach occur with a potential market coming back, then you would probably see the Australian dollar come back as well too. But the big question is going to be is how long and how far that's going to happen. But certainly from our point of view, look, I don't see a 44% fall like we saw during the GFC in that second wave of selling. You know, we're not, we don't have banks going bust. We're not seeing ATMs dry up with cash in that sort of scenario. So to me, it's more going to be a, you know, it might go back to the recent low. It might go back a bit lower, but sometimes you don't want to be the first person to arrive at the party is the best analogy that I always talk to my clients about. You know, you want to come in about midway through, so you got the benefit of working out whether it's good or not.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose, you know, moving through that, you know, I've got a few questions that I want us to sort of hash out onto the back of that Q&A webinar. Obviously, you know that webinar that you went through last week, you know, it obviously went for 2.5 hours, so it was another great webinar. Any sort of any sort of surprises or points you wanted to talk about off the back of that one? Or
look, I think there's a couple of key themes that were there in both the March and the April one. The first one would be Australian expats with CommSec accounts. That has created so many issues. You know, like I mentioned in the webinar last week, talking to a gentleman recently who used his parents' address on his CommSec account, been overseas for five years, and didn't have any non-resident withholding tax being deducted from the dividends because they classified him as a resident. He then had to go lodge 5 years' worth of tax returns to declare that income, which resulted in which resulted in five, you know, lots of tax return fees. And repayments and interest charges and those sort of things. So, you know, what should have been a good experience ended up being quite a cost experience into the thousands for him because he thought he'd just sort of take a shortcut and rather than setting his account up properly as a non-resident account, just sort of try and shortcut compliance and not aware of the unintended consequences of the share registry not knowing that he's a non-resident and those changes occurring from there.
Yeah, and I think from what I've seen from some of the data that came out, another theme I saw a lot of people asking more about, has there been an update on, I suppose, properties back in Australia, rental properties, even from state governments about the moratoriums, evictions, all those sort of things? There really hasn't been, to be honest. It's a bit concerning.
It is. It's you know, there's a bit of relief with respect to land tax that a lot of the states are, you know, providing. But, you know, when you look at, you know, a land tax bill versus the amount of rent you receive on a monthly basis, it's still outweighed incredibly by an incredible amount. you know,
yeah,
a land tax bill might be 1 or 2 months rent, not six. So you still got that 4 months rent defined. The other thing that I found quite concerning was, and I was doing some research before our webinar last week, was a lot of the insurers, the landlord insurance is not going to cover tenants.
No, one of the points I've got actually, you're spot on. Landlord insurance, COVID-19 is officially classified as a pandemic. Therefore, it is a non-insurable event, which a lot of, obviously, landlords are throwing their arms up in the air going, well, hang on, tenants can't pay their rent, surely.
Yeah. And there has to, and if you agree to a reduction, you can't claim back that difference in insurance.
Yep.
Or your insurance only kicks in once you evict the tenant, which you can't do for 6 months.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very unusual situation where claims can't be made just because, okay, well, if they're evicted, they can't be evicted because of the moratorium. Even if they break their lease, you're allowing them to break the lease. Therefore, you still can't make a claim. It's unusual. And then you're stuck with a property that you probably can't get tenanted because no open houses. You know, they're obviously, they're having to do walkthroughs and all those sort of things. I sort of gave my own example a little while ago, but that's exactly right. I mean, were there other sort of key themes that came about it, maybe regarding, I dare say, I've had a look, main residence exemption, that's still up in the air in terms of capital gains tax, how it all operates right now.
Yeah, look, we're still beating the drum on that and trying to raise as much visibility at the moment. We've had two MPs, the Shadow Treasurer and the Shadow Assistant Treasurer, respond saying, thank you for the update, please keep us posted. Virtue means, you know, nothing. We can't do anything. So, you know, not that we'll go up until the 29th of June, you know, to try and get this changed, because that wouldn't, you know, be the purpose. But for us, it needs to happen now or it doesn't happen at all. And, you know, weekly we're meeting people who are caught up in this event.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I dare say, you know, 2 months, we're staring down the barrel now where even if you were able to get your property listed, settlement, you know, regardless of the contract being signed in this financial year, it doesn't allow you to even do any tax financial planning to account for potential capital gains if you've owned the property for a very long time.
Yep.
Blown out the 6-year temporary absence rule. So, yeah, a lot of considerations around that, and I just don't think the government's going to get off their ass and do anything.
No, I mean, look, fair enough, and then they're busy, I get it, but this has got to affect mums and dads, you know, Australian expats. And certainly the government keeps saying they're there for the mums and dads, but unfortunately expats may be excluded from that that concern.
Yeah, that's right. And I suppose that feeds in and leads me into one of the first questions, which we've pretty much just addressed. It's on the main residence exemption. And the question was from the individual, you know, after the 1st of July, if I sell a property in Australia as a non-resident, will I need to pay full capital gains tax from the day I first acquired it? Well, yes. So it's, I mean, that's pretty straightforward. There's another interesting question that's come about that isn't related to capital gains tax or the main residence exemption. And it mainly relates to if we move back to Australia in the current year or next year, and I have an overseas company, which I set up in another country, what would be the situation for that company for Australian tax purposes in Australia? So they've set up a tax vehicle in another country where they're residing. They might be investing through it or trading through it, whatever it might be. They want to know what are the considerations for the ATO once they've returned.
Look, I mean, if it's temporary, the ATO have said you can still keep, you know, running on the assumption that you're a non-resident. As long as you, as soon as borders reopen, you return immediately to your country of domicile and residency.
Yeah.
They have also said that if you are earning income in Australia as part of that offshore work, that's not taxable. If you are earning income in Australia, which is local, that is taxable.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they announced that back in March, I think towards the end of March, where they're sort of giving that flexible relief. Hopefully, if current conditions continue, especially with travel overseas and Australia's borders being closed, you know, predicting till 2021, they give us another update at the end of the financial year. So in 2 months' time, where they're saying, okay, well, if your situation hasn't changed and you are stuck here purely because of COVID-19, then we're still happy to treat you as a non-resident under the assumption that you're not employed by a local company, you know, on PAYG or anything like that.
Yep. And look, I think it's smart, and, you know, like I've said a lot of times before, my wife and daughters are stuck back in Australia, so we're walking the walk as well. You know, we don't want them classified as tax residents. And, yeah, we're watching this one closely. And, you know, they are updating their frequently asked questions. You know, there was an update on the 23rd of April, which hasn't changed anything. So, you know, if you look at that, you would assume that as of the 23rd of April, it's still the status quo, keep continuing. But it'd be nice for them to come out and say, you know, hey, this is the scenario. But I think the problem is they just don't know when borders are going to reopen. So they don't want to provide a time frame. You know, they don't say, you know, for the next 3 months, you've got this if borders open next month.
Yeah, exactly right. But I'll be honest, I was pretty impressed the fact that the ATO did say something.
Yeah, because you should have forgotten.
Sort of, yeah, exactly right. Someone, I don't know, whoever was, you know, the decision maker behind announcing that flexibility, that's really good. I was shocked, to be honest. Next question. As an Australian expat without property or any other income stream in Australia, how would franked dividends be beneficial? It's an interesting one, that one.
Well, franked dividends are only beneficial if you are earning income from what we classify as a non-taxable property. So shares, managed funds, ETFs, LICs. Yep. You know, when you consider what's coming out of those sort of those benefits, it is an offset of the non-resident withholding tax. So if you're a resident in a country with a DTA with Australia, it's 15%, no DTA, 30%. Franking credits are obviously tax credit at 30%. So it goes through and nets everything off. The big one that does cause a bit of confusion is if you are in a country with a DTA where the non-resident withholding tax is only 15% and your tax rate is, your franking credit is 30, you don't get half back. Use it or lose it.
That's right. Non-residents, regardless of the situation, will never get access to a franking credit refund. I remember a long time ago I sort of spoke to a new inquiry and they told me that they had been lodging their tax returns for the last 10 years and getting franking credit refunds. And it sort of shocked me. And I said, I don't think you're a non-resident then. No, you know, that's the only income I earn. But so, well, you shouldn't be receiving the franking credit refunds at all. You're going to have to pay that tax back or keep treating yourself as an Australian tax resident. But then you've also got to go back and look at the overseas income you've been earning from your job. So, yeah, exactly right. So refer them on to a very good accountant, but I think they didn't receive any advice at all. So make sure receiving advice when, if you are receiving franking credit refunds right now. Sometimes if we receive a tax refund and we're a non-resident, you might already be paying things like quarterly PAYG installments because you've got rental income or something like that. That's very different. But definitely make sure you've got some good advice there to understand that. One of the next questions actually is very close to home, Brett, Dubai. It is common in Dubai to receive an end of service payment extremely late. So obviously a few months after you've left Dubai potentially.
Yep.
What would the implications be in terms of taxation if I receive a large payment after having returned to Australia and becoming a resident of Australia for tax purposes? So obviously receiving that end of service gratuity a lot later.
Look, to me, I think you'd have to be on the front foot and go straight to the ATO for a private ruling. You know, just based on the weight of evidence in terms of normally you would receive it as a non-resident and then you would repatriate back into the country. You know, if you are stuck in Australia and you can't return back to Dubai because the borders are closed and you've lost your job, that's why you're back in Australia. So to me, I think spending, $2,000 for a private ruling is money well spent there, because you could actually get an argue your point, with email chains and documents to say, hey,
that's right.
You know, I'm not drawing this down as an Australian resident. I'm drawing this down as a non-resident. I just happen to be as a temporary resident at the moment because of COVID-19. So that's where private rulings are especially useful, because you get a chance to really build your case. Do not put your head in the sand and just assume, because then 2 or 3 years later, it'll come back to bite you in the backside.
That's right.
Because the ATO's got all that data. And then you've got to try and argue the point, and it looks like you're trying to hide something, as opposed to if you've got a leg to stand on it, you know, go forward and say to the ATO through an accountant, this is what's going on. This is why this has occurred like that. I normally would have received this as a resident of Dubai, but because I'm stuck in Australia right now, I'm receiving it as a temporary resident in Australia.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you're exactly right in terms of proof. You know, getting that private ruling, it's almost an insurance policy, to be honest, worth its weight in gold, as well as, you know, having all the documentation, you know, the fact that it was an entitlement that you should have received as a non-resident compared to obviously being back in Australia, that should hold up and assist the tax accountant with lodging that private ruling and having in your favour. But again, it's case by case and not necessarily all things are aligned like that. But moving on, that was a really good question. This one's a bit unique again, but easily answered. What is the rate of capital gains tax for non-residents?
Starts at 32.5 cents on the first dollar. No tax-free threshold. You know, cities earn that first dollar, one third of it's going straight to the ATO.
That's right. I mean, I know a lot of countries, especially the US, that you know, if you've held an investment for longer than 12 months, you actually have a different tax rate. But again, Australia's capital gains tax rates are just our marginal tax rates. Non-residents, obviously, as Brett just mentioned, first tax tier, 32.5%, up to 90,000, and then tiers up again very aggressively. So
yes,
be careful there. Next item on the agenda, what happens if expats are forced back to Australia in March, but due to virus issues in their home country, they can't get back within the first 183 days. When does their residency start in Australia? Well, I suppose we've already pretty much touched base on this about the current sort of flexi rule that they've got there, and they'll be updating guidance, I'd say, within the next month or two towards the end of the financial year, with having that 3-month temporary absence relief.
Yep. And look, I think, you know, a lot of the people who are asking these questions are primarily based in countries where the borders have closed to both residents and tourists. So, you know, we heard just not only 30 minutes ago that in Dubai they're saying they want tourists to start coming in as of 1 July, which would mean that, yeah, if you look at, say, you're in Australia from the 1st of March, surely yep. they'll let residents back in before they'll let tourists in. So they might let residents back in June. So we might actually meet that 3-month requirement. It's just a matter of watch that space.
Yep. This is a question about CompSec, actually. Been living overseas for over 3 Australian financial years as an investor using CompSec. I've never done a tax return. What do you think the implications might be? You did give already a pretty good example here, because the fact that they've got a CompSec account and they're a non-resident, I'm somewhat impressed.
Yeah. Now, look, I mean, usually it's them taking the approach of putting their mum's address or dad's address or someone. And out of all these things, the biggest problem you do find with a lot of these things is, you know, the data is matchable. You know, they can look at your tax file number, which is on your CompSec account, and they can look at your lodgements and or lack thereof, and then they can just go up. And the problem with the ATO is when they come to you, they won't say, James, you haven't declared your dividend income because of non-residence. They will come to you in a very obtuse way, and I'll say, what haven't you told us? So then suddenly you're questioning everything, you know? And then you're
over-disclosed. No.
But then, you know, you may actually disclose stuff that you didn't think was a problem that may be a problem that was got nothing to do with the original problem. So
it can blow
up, and I've seen it time and time again. It blows up.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I'd hate to be a US tax resident, just the way the IRS is. I mean, the ATO's not too bad compared to a lot of the penalties and the lodgements we have to do over in the US. And that sort of ties into one of the next questions, actually, green card holder. So I have been in the US on a green card for 10 years. I've not applied for citizenship. As I understand it, being on a green card in the US for over 7 years makes me liable for the Hart Taxation Act, or more commonly referred to as the exit tax or expat tax. What is this exit tax? And, you know, what is the sort of criteria that could capture me by this? It's a bit of a lengthy one, that question.
And look, we see a lot of these conversations going on Facebook groups about, you know, going from a green card to citizenship. And, you know, there's a lot of people that are going, yeah, it's great, fantastic, you get a vote and all this sort of nonsense. To me, the big difference is if you intend to leave US at some point, you can hand that green card back, and your taxing liability or taxing responsibilities or obligations with the IRS cease when you hand it back. As opposed to being a citizen, you can't just hand back citizen. You have to renounce it and that costs about $3,000 to $5,000 Australian. You have to actually go to an embassy and they will interview you as to why. And if you don't give a good reason why, they can actually knock you back.
Well, why would anyone want to give back their passport of the greatest country in the world, in inverted commas? So. Yes.
and that's what people don't realise, you know, going through all these sort of scenarios.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think with the exit tax, you know, there's no sort of set rate on the exit tax. Yes, if you've held that lawful permanent resident status, which is a green card or passport for more than 6 full calendar years, I should say, or in 8 calendar years, very different. That's when there's another set of criteria. There's 3 tests. You've got your net worth test, $2 million US, your average tax liability from the previous 3 calendar years, which should be more than $160,000 US. So that's a very large amount of tax to be paying to the IRS each year. And then another test is not being able to certify on form 8854 that we're up to date with our lodgements with the IRS. If we only have to satisfy one of those tests to be considered what's this called a covered expatriate, and that's when we do fall into the exit tax. And again, there's another set of criteria. Not going to go into it, but we do have, I believe, a video on our YouTube channel. I'm going through that a little bit more in depth.
We do, and I think the important part too from the asset point is it's global assets, not assets in...
In the US.
In the US. So if you've got an investment property in Australia, Sydney and Melbourne, I mean, there's probably a million just there.
Yep.
You know, if you've got a couple hundred grand sitting in super, you know, you're up to 1.2, you know, it can rise pretty quickly.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And people don't realise that. And then, you know, they leave it too late and they're trying to scramble, oh, you know, crap, how do I get myself under this net worth test, which is pretty hard to do once you're at that point. The exchange rate might help, to be honest, because we're seeing what
it is at the moment. Yeah, the Australian peso.
Yep. Hey, come on. but anyways, next question. This is not a bad one. If I go back to Australia and reside there and rent and sell my property in Abu Dhabi a year later for less than what I purchased it, do I still have to pay capital gains tax to the ATO? That's a really good question. And I suppose I'm happy to address that one. If it's under the assumption that you're returning back to Australia, you don't have another main residence that you own back in Australia, you're just renting, you can actually place the main residence exemption on that property over in Abu Dhabi. Therefore, if you're renting out for a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, it means that upon selling it within that 6 year temporary absence rule period, it would not be a capital gains tax transaction. You know, in the event that's sort of taking place for you, might take place over the next few years, definitely seek advice around that. But we can use the main residence exemption if we don't own any property in Australia on a foreign property after we've returned. So it actually gives us a bit of time. But remember, that is under the assumption that you haven't returned back to Australia, purchased a new property and moved into it and essentially established a new main residence. That's when obviously the tax calculations get a little bit more complex around working out, I suppose, the apportionment practice and those sort of things.
Yeah, no, I think you hit a very important point because people don't understand that the main residence can extend overseas.
Yeah, and a lot of people aren't aware of that. Even though they've removed it for expats, it's very unusual that when you return, you can still place it on foreign properties. It's just reflects the ATO and the government. Another item I've got here is if we invest the proceeds of the sale of our former main residence and we invest in shares, what percentage of tax do we pay on the income that's generated from that portfolio? Well, this is ideally just referring to dividends, I would assume.
Just depends on the franking credit. So if you were investing 100% in Australian shares that all provided franking credits, then, you know, more than likely 0% tax.
Yeah.
In saying that, we don't ascribe to the process of just investing in Australia. You know, all of our portfolios are globally diversified. The tax consideration of the foreign assets, the income that comes from those, it's not that big a deal because income or dividend yields from foreign assets are quite low anyway. So if you are in the United States or Singapore or UK, yes, you will pay 15% withholding tax on that dividend income, but if the yield's only 1%, it's not exactly guessing you're broke. Whereas the lion's share of the income coming out of the portfolio will be the Australian side where average yields are sort of 4.2 to 4.5%. That's when you don't want to be paying that 15 or 30% income.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, usually platforms that are able to treat you as a non-resident can also account for the automatic withholding amounts. Whereas if they don't know you're a non-resident, like hypothetical ComSec, they won't know what to do. They won't deduct
anything. They just pay you 100% of the dividend. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. This next one's a good one. I was told that if I was to make a contribution to super from the earnings of my rental income, that I would no longer be considered a non-resident for tax purposes and would have to declare all my overseas income and pay tax on this. Is that correct?
I would love to meet the person that told that person that. It was just, when that question came through, you can put yourself in my shoes. It's 9:30 at night. I'm just going, what? You know, we're like, what?
I mean, if it's the accountant, I'd get a new accountant. But again, superannuation, it is agnostic regardless of your tax residency. Non-resident, Australian tax resident, we can still contribute to it. However, if we have a self-managed super fund, that's when we need to be careful. You know, running a self-managed super fund is running the gauntlet if it's not set up correctly as a non-resident, because we can breach central management control and therefore the super can lose its concessional treatment and we end up getting, I suppose, penalised by having to pay 47% tax on the actual assets as well as the income in that year that we're audited. So
you pretty much lose half your balance.
That's right. So just reframing it, we can contribute to super as a non-resident. There's two types, non-concessional contributions or concessional contributions. One is pre-tax, concessional, non-concessional is after-tax. It does not impact our current residency situation. I'd go and question the accountant that gave you that or start searching for an accountant that has expat clients.
Yeah, and I think it's a very good point. I think it's, you know, to me, the importance of, and I had this conversation three times yesterday, you know, there are some very good accountants and financial planners out there, but their scope and their understanding and their experience may not extend to, you know, the overseas realm. They may have your best interests at heart, but they don't know. They don't know what they don't know. And just because you're an accountant or a financial planner, it doesn't mean you understand how the dots join from an overseas perspective when you're dealing with two jurisdictions. And quite often, you know, you and I have calls with, you know, an expat's accountant who'll virtually be going, okay, can you tell me about this? Can you, like, we're educating them, which is great. You know, I love to see that because then the same problem's not going to happen in the future. But it's those who sort of stand on their soapbox saying, this is what it is, this is what it is, when it's absolute, complete, utter bullshit.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and it is sometimes concerning when you do speak to an accountant and go, okay, well, was deemed disposal done in these shares? And they go, what's that? And you're like, okay, well, take a step back. But again, you're right. You know, education, it's always key. And obviously, you know, assuring that's not again. But again, it just means, you know, using accountants that have expat clients that are match fit. We've talked about match fit too often.
Yeah. Yeah, look, you got to be, it's something that, you know, we watch the ATO every day. We watch all these things every day just for the basic value of Australian expats. If you're not watching it, you will miss so many things. You know, there will be so many little changes, whether it's at a federal or a state level in Australia or overseas, that affects, you know, sort of foreign residents as well too. So it's, you know, and just because it was the case, you know, last February doesn't mean it's going to be the case in 2 years' time. You know, the goalposts.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they absolutely do. And I think it's going to be interesting to see what comes out actually towards the end of the year when the budget finally gets released. I think October was what they're saying, but who knows what's going to come from that, to be honest.
Massive tax reform is the only way I can see us getting out of this. You know, they're talking about today when Josh Frydenberg, certainly not my friend at the moment with the MRE, they're saying he'll probably release a budget deficit of around about $100 billion Australian dollars in the May the 12th. I don't know why that date they said that, but, you know, you know, that to me originally was probably the original budget date, but the budget's been pushed back to October, but who knows. I didn't get a chance to go look at the article, but to me, you know, they're going to have massive tax reform. I can certainly expect there to be changes to the income, to the personal and corporate tax rates, as well as GST, even though both ScoMo and Josh came out and said, we're not touching GST. I think they have to.
Yeah, I can see it going up, to be honest. I've got a few clients that are a bit concerned around GST, what might take place there. But Brett, why don't we wrap it up there? I mean, I've got plenty of other questions, but let's push them onto the next episode with another market update. Let's wrap it up. Expat Chat 16 will be done and we'll get this up pretty quickly as well.
That's a wrap, mate. Good to talk to you again as always, and see you on the next episode.
You too, mate. Speak soon.
Thanks, mate.
See you, mate. Bye.